Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
This week on Dear Science, Bronny spoke with Alan Blackman about possible signs of life on Venus, ice-cold hummingbirds, and Panadol increasing risk-taking behaviour.
So, Alan, about this first topic, we've got this gas on Venus showing that life may be possible. Well, what is this gas and what produces it?
Well, I guess in order to answer that question, we need to know a little bit about Venus and why this is so, I guess, unusual and exciting. So I guess if you're looking for a planet that could possibly sustain life, Venus would be one of your last choices. I guess David Bowie many years ago sang about life on Mars, and you know that's the planet that all the attention or most of the attention has focused on in terms of life. Now the reason that Venus hasn't been thought of as a candidate for life is the fact that it really is not conducive to it in any way, shape, or form. So the surface temperature on Venus is around about 450 degrees Celsius, which is surprisingly the hottest of any planet in the solar system. That's even hotter than Mercury, which is way closer to the sun. The atmosphere is around about 96% carbon dioxide. That's not great. The pressure at the surface is around about 100 times the Earth's atmospheric pressure. And to top it all off, you've got sulfuric acid in the atmosphere. So really, if you're looking for somewhere that you think could perhaps harbor life in the solar system, Venus would be about one of your last choices anyway. However,
yeah. And I think they did say in the article about 50 kilometers above the surface is where you'd be. That's where it would be a nice climate, nice temperature.
Indeed, yes. So all of those sort of measurements are at the surface. If you're right, if you do go sort of 50 kilometers up, then it's very Earth-like apparently. So in terms of both pressure and temperature. So what has happened in the last few days, and this is very exciting, this is a big story in science, is that workers in the US and the UK and Japan have reported that they have detected a gas called phosphine at a concentration of around about 20 parts per billion in the Venusian atmosphere. And this was published this week in the journal Nature Astronomy, so you would think it's pretty good stuff. So just a little bit of background as to what phosphine is and how they came across this. So they were looking in the microwave region using big telescopes, and they started off doing this search in 2017, so training a telescope on Venus and looking at its sort of microwave signature, looking for particular compounds in its atmosphere, and they found a signature for this gas phosphine. And they were very, very surprised by that. And so they used another bigger telescope in the year 2019, and they got the same result. So this was a pretty undeniable signature for this gas phosphine. Now, what is phosphine? It's a very simple gas. It's got the chemical formula pH3. It's nasty. It's highly, highly toxic, very, very reactive. With oxygen, so if you put it in air, it will inflame. Now, having said that, it is produced on Earth, but the only way that it can be produced on Earth that we know is through elements of life. So, in other words, it's not sort of formed under the normal conditions that we have on Earth. So, where you find phosphine is in places that are what we call anaerobic, so there is no oxygen there. So places like swamps, for example, in your intestines, and in the bodies, if you want to call them that, of little microorganisms. And they seem to be the sort of the primary way that phosphine is manufactured on Earth, these microorganisms. So essentially, what these folk are saying is that if phosphine is there, then according to our knowledge of chemistry at the moment, pretty much the only way that it could get there would be through some sort of life process. And that's very, very exciting, obviously. Having said that, so phosphine is also present on other planets. So they've found phosphine on both Jupiter and Saturn. But the big difference there is that Jupiter and Saturn are what are called the gas giants. So these are enormous planets. We're talking very, very, very high pressures. We're talking very, very high temperatures at their core. And it is thought that the phosphine on those planets is a result of those very, very extreme conditions. Now, 50 kilometers up in the Venusian atmosphere, we don't have those extreme conditions. They're just like the conditions here on Earth. And so these folk have postulated that the fact that they can see the phosphine at this concentration at 20 parts per billion doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a significant amount. That means because it's so reactive, normally it would just sort of react with things and disappear, but the fact that you've got this constant concentration there means that it must be continually regenerating. There must be a source of it somehow, and they are postulating that that source is life. You know, fantastic stuff.
Right, and so, but it's an example of life not necessarily meaning life as we know it, right? Because there is no oxygen, so.
No, exactly. But, you know, we do have these things on Earth, these microorganisms that operate under anaerobic conditions, under conditions of no oxygen. So, it kind of is life as we have it here on Earth, okay? It's not... Mm-hmm. Life is, as you know, as we humans, we mammals understand it, where we are, you know, respirating using oxygen and stuff like that. These things can work in the absence of oxygen, and that's just what phosphine needs because of the fact that it is so very, very reactive with oxygen.
So, but we probably wouldn't be expecting a mission there anytime soon. Looks like Mars is probably still the best bet at this point.
Well, they have landed a few craft on Venus. The Russians were the first to do it, I think, sort of in the early 70s, and they took a couple of photographs before the whole thing dissolved or whatever happened. And then they put some balloons in the atmosphere as well in the 80s. So the Russians are the big players in Venus. Mm. But yeah, you know, obviously any excuse to fire off a space probe and see what's happening there. So no, very, very, very interesting.
Mm. All right, then, to move to something completely different, with the second topic, we've got these hummingbirds living in the Andes mountain ranges, which obviously get pretty cold. So how have these hummingbirds learnt to adapt?
Yeah, this is really quite remarkable. I was lucky enough to see some hummingbirds when I was in the States once upon a time, and you know, they truly are extraordinary. The rate at which they flap those wings, you know, you just can't see them. They're really, really amazing. And because of this, they have a metabolic rate that is roughly around about 77 times that of a human. You know, we think we sort of go to the gym and get our heart pumping and everything like that. get this astonishes me. The heart of a hummingbird when it's flying is beating around about 1,000 beats per minute. Sorry, not per second, per minute. So, you know, that's pretty fast techno. That's, 1,000 beats per minute.
That's why they have to be eating all the time as well, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So they've got to keep that metabolic rate up, which means that they have got to feed essentially continuously. And you think, boy, that's got to be tough on them. How do they do this? How do they keep that metabolic rate up the whole time? And the answer is they don't. And this is found now, as you say, as a result of some workers who have been looking at these hummingbirds in the Andes. Now, these workers from the States went up to around about 3,800 meters, which is just taller than the top of Aoraki Mount Cook, and they got 26 birds, and they started monitoring the body temperatures of these birds, especially at night. And what they found quite astonished them. They found that one bird, in fact, got down to a body temperature of 3.3 degrees Celsius at night. Uh-huh. And so, you know, our normal body temperature is about sort of 37 degrees, which is, you know, that's the hummingbird's daytime sort of temperature as well. The hummingbirds apparently have this capacity to lower their body temperature by anywhere between 10 and 30 degrees Celsius at night. And what they do is they go into the state of torpor, and that's essentially sort of a mini hibernation, essentially. You know how bears and stuff like that hibernate during the winter. Essentially what's happening with these hummingbirds is that they seem to be doing a mini hibernation every night. And in the state of torpor. They're absolutely motionless. Apparently, you know, they look dead. You can pick them up. They don't respond. Their body temperatures are really, really, really cold. And their heartbeat drops. So their heartbeat drops to sort of human level. So about 50 beats per minute, which is, I guess, really, really slow for a hummingbird. But the whole point of this appears to be by lowering their body temperature, then the difference between their body temperature and the external temperature is minimized. And that then means that they don't have to expend energy keeping their body temperature up. That seems to be the whole point of it. So they're trying to minimize the difference between the body temperature and the external temperature. Mm. And that means that they got to expend less energy. And so they don't have to do this sort of continuous feeding at night. They don't have to keep warm. They're not wasting energy, I guess, on keeping warm. And you know, this is the way that these hummingbirds operate in the upper Andes. Now, I guess one of the obvious questions about all of this is, okay, so these guys go into the state of torpor. They're just lying on the ground. They're looking dead. You think they'd be, you know, goners for predators. At night, but apparently at 3,800 meters in the Andes, there aren't too many predators up there. So, you know, they seem to have adapted, evolved, whatever, this ability to do this in the absence of predators. And, you know, quite remarkable, 3.3 degrees Celsius to drop your body temperature 30 degrees every night, and then, you know, wake up in the morning and away, and away you go again. It's you know, nature is just astonishing.
Well, especially when you consider, they said here that in humans, if our body temperature drops even by 2%, not to 2%, but by 2%, then we're in a state of hypothermia. So it is really remarkable.
And we're in absolute trouble. I think the lowest recorded body temperature that anybody has sort of recovered from is something like around about, I think, 26, 27, something like, I think. Mm. But, you know, these birds, amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Crazy. Wow, yeah, but not a technique we'd probably expect any of our native birds to adopt, because there's probably a few too many predators here for that.
Well, you know, the good old wetter, they actually, their body fluids freeze in winter.
Mm. Wow.
And and they can actually survive that. So, wow. You know, we think humans are pretty amazing. Hell, the whole, you know, animal kingdom is pretty amazing. So
yeah. All right, well then, to move on to the third topic here, we've got this pain relief is actually increasing, they seem to think. So people's risky behavior making them less risk averse. So what drugs in particular are we talking about there?
Yeah, well, this is the most common drug on the planet. I think I'm correct in saying that. And that's good old paracetamol. You know, that's the thing that you pop as soon as you start feeling, you know, a little bit crook, or you've got a pain or something like that. And from the data that I could find, and this is only from the UK, so they reckon there's about 70 tablets of paracetamol per person per year in the UK. Mm. You know, so think of that worldwide, that's an awful lot of paracetamol. And so some workers in the US had been doing a study of a possible link now between paracetamol and, as you say, risk-taking behavior. And what they did find was that, yes, seemingly there does seem to be some link that if you take paracetamol, that you are more likely to do riskier things, which is very, very interesting. So the way that they did this was that they took 500, or at least 500, as they said, university students, and they either gave them paracetamol or a placebo, stuck them in front of a computer screen, and on this computer screen was a balloon, and you could inflate the balloon by clicking your mouse. The more you inflated it, the more money that you would get, okay? So. But if your balloon popped, then you'd lose all of your money. So you give the students the paracetamol or the placebo, sit them down in front of their computer and tell them, right, where you go. You know, the money that you make on this, you get to keep, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so what they found was that the students who were on the paracetamol were more likely to pop their balloons, so that they were indulging in riskier behavior. Okay, so And what they said that their ability to perceive and evaluate risks looked to be more impaired when they were on paracetamol than when they were on the placebo. And that's probably got to be a bit of a worry, I would imagine, given that paracetamol is such a widely used drug. You know, even things like perhaps, you know, jumping in the car after you've had a paracetamol. You know, are you going to overtake on that blind corner or whatever? Yeah.
And they even expressed concerns for possibly COVID-19 in the article.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah, if people are taking paracetamol because, you know, they're feeling a little bit crook, which could be the early stages of COVID, yes, indeed. You know, you're going to go out there without your mask on and, you know, ignore those rules, et cetera, et cetera. And they were also... during the study, they were asking the students questions about, you know, actually indulging in risky behavior, like, you know, going bungee jumping, or whether you would bet a day's salary on the outcome of a sporting event, or whether you'd drive without a seatbelt or whatever. And again, the responses to those answers from the kids who were on the paracetamol, again, sort of showed that they were contemplating, I guess, carrying out these things more than the people who are on the placebo. Mm-hmm. So that's a bit of a worry. And I guess something that's also coupled to this study, although it wasn't investigated in the study, was the fact that actually paracetamol is not necessarily the wonder drug that people necessarily think it is. And apparently in cases of things like, for example, chronic back pain or arthritis, it's actually no better than a placebo. So, you know, there's two things there. You're taking a drug that could be ineffective that is leading you to riskier behavior. So maybe somebody really wants to do some, you know, very in-depth studies on paracetamol, which I'm sure that they are doing, and, you know, just see whether we can't perhaps get, you know, maybe a better, less risky, I guess, all-round pain-relieving drug that everyone can take.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.